Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Lauren P. Razor of the wonderful show called Razor Law. I didn't create the law, but I just like the catchy Razor Law. This show, again, we're going to talk a little bit more and end our last segment on divorcing New York style. And it is a four-part show that talks about marriage and divorces and how you get a divorce in New York. I talked about last week the filing of a summons and complaint. On the summons and complaint, you have to give notice of three things: the child support guidelines. In addition to that, you have to give notice that you can't take property and transfer it before you get married. And also, there is something new called the alimony guidelines. So it actually, alimony is money that's given to the particular spouse that doesn't have a lot of money. So what happens is on the summons and complaint of the party that wants a divorce has to draft it. I talked about the grounds for divorce last week. And after you establish whatever your grounds are, you draft it up, then you ask for what you want. You want alimony, you want child support, you want equitable distribution, which is the division of the marital property. You ask for all of those in the summons and complaint, and then you must serve the summons and complaint. Now, this is, of course, important that you must serve the person personally. You know, you sometimes people don't want to accept the service, so the process server throws it over the fence. As long as they drop it at your knees or drop it on the floor in front of you, even if you try to throw it away and don't take it, pretty much you have been served. So the process server has to come to you, and usually when you are the person asking for the divorce, you have to give the process server a picture of the person that you want to have served, or you have to explain. The process server, who could be a friend, will have to explain that they are, you know, they know the person. So if you have a friend serve the divorcing spouse or a person that you want to divorce, that person has to say, I've known your spouse or your husband for over 10 years, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then they can also be the process server. Now, people have asked me this question last week. They have these services. They say, oh, you can, you know, it's like $9.99 or $6.99 or something to that effect. And they tell you that they can serve, you know, get a divorce without, you know, any issues on default, or get a divorce without the person showing up. What does that mean, getting a divorce without the person showing up? It means that you serve the person. The person may not even know that they've been served. And after you serve the person, you have approximately 20 to 30 days, depending on your jurisdiction. For the person who was served, they have to answer. Failing to answer means that you get divorced by default. So, for example, I want a divorce from X. I have my process server serve X. X then does not answer or put in an answer. Now, you can put in an answer if you want to. The answer would have to have, could have some counterclaims. But so, for example, the answer could be, I deny everything that's in the complaint. One, I don't want to get a divorce. There is no irreconcilable differences. Or if somebody charges you with adultery, I didn't commit the adultery. You can deny all of the allegations that this person has said against you, and then you can also have counterclaims. So, for example, you can answer the divorce saying, I didn't do any of that stuff that person says I did. However, I am saying he or she did this to me, and I want all of this. So that is an answer. An answer is verified when you take your answer, you draft it up, you go to a process server, and then not process server, you go to a notary, and you have it your signature notarized. That is what they called a verified answer. A verified complaint is when you first start. The verified complaint is when I file a case against you because I want a divorce against you, and I have to have a complaint that is verified. Verified means really notarized, that you are saying that whatever is in there is actually true. So that starts a divorce. Then there is an answer. Then after there is an answer, you somehow, you know, what they call an RJI. Now, a summons and complaint, what does it cost you? A summons and complaint costs $210, $210. Okay. Then after the summons and complaint, here's the other cost. Process serving costs. You got to do that. After the process serving costs, let's see what else do you have to pay for. Then you would have to pay for RJI. What is an RJI? RJI is if you put the case on the calendar. You put the case on the calendar, and that is a request for judicial intervention. And that is an RJI, request for judicial. That's how the case magically gets on the calendar. It's an RJI. Okay, so now you now get the case on the calendar. Now, there are several ways to deal with the a divorce. Once a case gets on, they have something called mediation. If you don't have any property and you particularly don't hate your spouse, then maybe mediation would work. But I can tell you this, I think I said it in the last show, mediation never works if the couple can't communicate in the first place and they pretty much don't like each other in the second place. Usually a mediation is a place where people just air their dirty laundry and say why they hate each other. However, when you get before a court of law, I prefer going straight into the court because the court can have you sit down and have you work things out, have you sit down and have you work out a settlement. That's what that's what a court can do, which is a good thing. It helps you in working it out. They send you over to the coroner. The clerk is somebody that you have to work with. You know, that is the clerk of the court, have to go into the corner of the courtroom, and both spouses and yourself, because you've now put the case on the calendar, and both spouses, husband and wife, are now have to sit down, and they will have to work out a settlement, and that's pretty much what has to happen. Let's see. So now, okay, so now we're talking about the divorce. We've actually filed a case. The case is now on the calendar. You can work out. Now, for example, you can work out visitation. There's what they call, it's a preliminary order that the judge will give. The preliminary order outlines visitation, outlines who stays in the house. Outlines who does one of the spouses have to pay a short-term alimony while the case is going on? Is there rent that has to be paid? Who pays the bills during the time are going through the divorce? Generally, the money spouse is the person who has to foot the bill. In addition to that, you know, there's temporary child support, and it's called a in limine motion, pendente lite motion that has to be filed by the court. So, for example, you want your spouse to pay child support, temporary child support, temporary alimony, you need rent. There's a pendente lite application that you or your lawyer, probably your lawyer most of all, would have to make in order for you to get those on a temporary basis, not a full-time basis, but a temporary basis until the court makes a decision. Who has custody of the children, child or children, during that time is the subject of what they call, a pendente lite motion. It is a subject of the pendente lite motion. It means that you will ask for temporary custody before it's actually decided for custody. You have to ask for it. You will have to make, and whether the spouse is ordered to leave the house, depending on what the scenarios are. Now, each week I have so many funny scenarios. Okay, so going down the line, I have a couple. They had to live in the house. The court didn't order them to go out the house. They shared the kitchen. The court gave them times. The court does do this. That's why I'd rather go to court, because at the end of the day, you don't have to get it. You'll get a divorce. When you go for mediation, if it doesn't work, then you have to file and go to court. You want to do it the whole package. Like I said, if there's no property involved and you pretty much don't hate each other, mediation could work. But so, for example, there was a couple. The couple lived in the house. The judge didn't order anybody to leave the house. They had to share the kitchen on a time basis. The judge said, you can go in the kitchen this time, that time. You can go in the kitchen this time, that time. The same thing for laundry. It went down to that. On this time, on Saturday, you can do the laundry. On this time, the spouse, the wife can do the laundry. On this time, the husband can do the laundry. So all of that was really examined and determined by a court. The one thing we always say, if you don't determine yourself, between each other, if you don't do that about children, then there's going to be a court that decides at the end of the day who has custody of your children. A court will decide that if you, the couple and yourself, can't decide it. And when a court decides child support or child custody cases, it could be a battle. The parents would have to testify. It is expensive. You have to hire, they would have to be, the court would appoint a lawyer for the children or the child. The court would appoint a psychologist or an expert, which is very costly, because the court is going to need guidance if they're going to make a decision. It's not, and you would have to testify, okay? And so would this, all the spouses. Sometimes the spouses' family members, and then the therapist would have to examine the spouses also. They would have to be interviewed. All of that takes place if there is a custody dispute. So divorces can be costly if they are contested. Just remember that. Divorces are costly if they are contested. Now, the other thing you can ask for, I should have remembered this from the beginning, legal fees. What made me forget that? Each side can ask for the other person, depending on who has the most money, to pay the legal fees. Why is that? That is because the court does not want to put, say, for example, there is a stay-at-home wife. the court does not want to put, just because you decided to take care of the children and you don't have a job, that was a family decision, all of a sudden your spouse, who has a lot of money, can now, you know, get the best lawyer. And because you were a stay-at-home spouse, you don't have money to get the best lawyers. The court said that's wrong. That puts you at a that puts the other person at a disadvantage. So now that person who doesn't have a whole lot of money petitioned the court to get the spouse that has a lot of money to pay their legal fees. And let me tell you, it does happen, okay? So not only will you be responsible if you are the moneyed spouse, and say you have a client making over $200,000. I had a client making over $250,000. He had to fork over $30,000-something just to pay his spouse's legal fees. So that's another thing you must consider when you get a privately retained lawyer. You must consider the cost of divorces. Sometimes they're flat fees. And sometimes they are hourly. The top lawyers that are handling divorces are $250 an hour and up. Flat fees are anywhere from $5,000, depending on the complication of the divorce, up to $10,000. And they can go higher if there is a dispute about the children. The other part of it, too, is this is where it comes in. You'll need experts on various things. Here are the experts that you'll need. One expert is on how to calculate, and when we talk about equitable distribution, that is the marital assets. Marital assets are the house, the pensions, all of the things, bank accounts, Swiss bank accounts, all kinds of things, cars, fur coats, furniture. All of those are part of equitable distribution. And in order to calculate the value of pensions, the real value of pensions, and it becomes complicated because you may have had a pension prior to marriage, and then after marriage, the pension skyrocketed because of the market. You may have to have an expert evaluate the before marriage, which is not, the spouse is not entitled to, the after part, and then also, even if you say the spouse is not entitled to that particular, for example, let me just give you a quick example, a house. Okay, a house. You bought a house prior to marriage. You're not off the hook. If during the marriage you rebuilt the house, you rebuilt that house, and that house is goes up in value because you're using marital assets to increase the value of the house. That value could be part, it's called passive evaluation. It's nothing you're doing. You didn't build the house, but the value has increased for whatever reason during the time of the marriage, because you put in a new roof, you put in a swimming pool, you put in an extra room, you redid the entire house, and that was during the time of marriage. That would valuation of the house. Now it was, when you first bought it, it was $150,000, and after the marriage, and you put in work, and your spouse is helping you to put stucco on the side of it, and so forth and so on, and now the house is $1 million, your spouse equitable distribution may be from that $150,000 before marriage to up to that $1 million. That can, even though it was purchased before the marriage. So you have to be careful. It's not a cut and dry scenario. So those are all of the things that you have to look out for. Divorces can be expensive. The most important thing, the child custody is significant. Who's going to get custody of the children? I will say to you, the majority of the time, now, and people don't want to hear it, but the truth is the truth. The majority of the time, unless the female has some real, real, real issues, it is almost 90% that a court will not take custody away from a mother. Oh, I know what I'm about to hear and say, and people are going to say, oh, my God, the men are going to say, that's not right. I raised a child from this, that, and the other. Well, I say the majority of cases I've seen, they do not take the child away from the natural mother. Now, what they sometimes do is there's what they call share custody. I had a situation in which the father lived on the block in one house and the mother lived down the block in another house, and the children were going back and forth. There was absolute shared custody where neither spouse was required to pay child support because the child was in both of their houses half of the time. If the kid was like a ping pong ball, you know, he could go back and forth at will, which in a way is good, but in a way it was crazy because the child could see every argument. They were right almost next to each other, and the child can go back and forth. If there's any arguments, the child will be able to see it back and forth. But that was shared custody, and that was something that you also – and then there's joint custody. There's really no joint custody. The child has to live somewhere. So it's going to be – the custody is going to be premise. It's really joint custody and joint decision-making. But the child is going to have a permanent resident somewhere. And that is for child support purposes also. If the child is – if you even have joint custody – and it's really joint custody and joint decision-making where the primary residence is with one of the spouses, that spouse usually is the one that's going to get child support. So joint custody and joint decision-making, if it's just joint decision-making, that's not going to get you out of child support. And so these are all of the things, and then, of course, there's custody. One parent has it over the other. Joint custody, joint decision-making really means joint decision-making, and usually you lay it out what kinds of decisions each other should make, how they should consult with each other, how one spouse cannot make a decision without consulting. But usually there's a final way that the court outlines who breaks the tie. So that's where the complicated part comes in. Who breaks the tie? You want your son or daughter to play football, and the other spouse says, I don't want my daughter to play football. The question is, who breaks the tie in joint decision-making? In most cases, the courts and the lawyers will lay out a professional. So, for example, if there's a sports teacher, you go to that person. If it's an issue about medical, you let the pediatrician have final word. If whatever the issue is, you have a professional break the tie. Then if you can't have a professional, if you really believe that your child should not be engaged in football at an early age and you feel that it's a danger to the welfare of the child by participating, then you have to come back to court. There's my settlement agreements, because you can agree to settle while you're in court, are so lengthy. I cover every base that I could possibly cover. Also, the issue will be tuition that you have to look at. That it can also be something you ask for. Okay, so here's the deal on tuition. You may be entitled to child support, but when that child goes away to school, the spouse who plays child support can petition to the court that since the child is not fully living in the household, that they can ask for reduced child support. So that's what happens when the children go to college. Child support is up to the age of 21, and I, you know, 21, the child can still receive child support if they are in college and not independent. But we'll pick it up, and that's love and marriage can be costly. There may be decisions to stay for various reasons, but like a horse and carriage, sometimes there's no love in marriage. Signing off, Lauren Razor. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.